Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you so much for tuning in. Today we have Ki Hai joining us. Ki is somebody who I got introduced to and just had a great story. He's one of those people who came out of the gate quickly, went to a top university, ended up at a hedge fund, and made partner at a very, very, very young age. He had all the money and success that people look for, right? The stature, the finances. He's in the game, as you say. And yet with all of this, he decided to walk away. His friends literally thought he was so crazy. I can't remember the number, but he was receiving daily text messages saying, you know, what's wrong with you? What are you doing? He left to start blogging and writing about investment, making change, and he has a weekly newsletter of over 15,000 people. He writes for Quartz as an entrepreneur in residence, and he writes about productivity, self-discovery, and all sorts of different topics. He's a really cool guy. He has a lot to say on the topic of productivity and, you know, change. He does these monthly meetups in New York, and they're moving over to San Francisco. He's been a TEDx talk, and he's done all of this in a very, very short period of time. I know you're going to enjoy today's show because it's a really cool story, somebody who just made a huge change. Check him out. He also created something called Rad Reads. You can find his website on our website, Rad, R-E-A-D-S, Rad Reads. And yeah, I hope you like today's show. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, and today we have Kay joining us. Hey, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am great. I'm excited for today's show because Kay speaks, writes, and blogs and all on this topic that I'm so passionate about, and this podcast is focused on. We were chatting before the show and I was like taking notes, like, oh my God, we could talk about this and this and this. So I'm very excited to have you on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we hop into these topics that I hold so near and dear to my heart, and I know you do as well, you have, you know, that story, that awesome story that people read about and people are reading about you. You were working in Wall Street. Can you take us through, you know, those earlier days working on Wall Street, the decision to leave, and just fill us in on life before you became a writer about abundance, compassion, fear?
All right, let's go. So I grew up in New York City, and my parents had immigrated here in 73. I was born in 79. And my dad would always say, we may not be the smartest, but we're the hardest working. And that aphorism just kind of carried me throughout my life, and especially the earlier part of my life. And so, you know, growing up in New York City, I did not experience a lot of the fun things that you see in the different movies and TV shows. It was head down, go to school, do gymnastics, play the violin. When I was rebelling, I was playing Magic the Gathering. So you probably have a sense of which kid I was in the high school. But I was very assiduous. I would, you know, use my own allowance to buy SAT books. So I was that kid. Uh-huh. Fast forward, and I ended up going to Yale as an undergraduate. And when I graduated, this was in 2001, the banks basically would sweep across campus, and it did not matter what major you had. They just wanted people who were thoughtful and smart, and they just hired you into these different investment banking programs.
Right, and so, super high-paying packages, right?
Yeah, and they are for 21-year-olds.
Yeah,
and promise is even beyond. I mean, it's insane amounts of money. Not only that, but it's so glorified in the media, especially this is pre both tech. I mean, it's the middle of the first tech boom. So this was truly the masters of the universe.
Yeah.
From Bonfire of the Vanities. So you have me, kind of nerdy kid that's being seduced, literally seduced by these banks where they come and they buy you multi-hundred-dollar bottles of wine. You don't even drink $5 beers at that point in your life, and it's all very tempting, and a lot of people, a lot of writers, English majors, history majors, kind of decided to kind of step on that path.
Right, right.
And so I stepped on, and it is brutal. I mean, you're talking about probably 16 hour work days, six days a week. And then you had an easy day on Sundays, which was like 6 to 8 hours.
Right. No, my brother's dear friend, who I knew since I was in kindergarten, did this. I mean, he had an apartment in New York City. You think he's like living the life. I went to visit him. He just has a mattress on the floor. And mm-hmm. he got like a rack from a clothing store where his suits would be. And that was it. Like, his entire apartment was just suits and this mattress. I'm like, dude, what, like, what kind of life is this? Right. And yeah, he'd work those 16 hours. And then he had a thing on Sunday. He'd pull an all nighter to Monday.
Get ready for the week.
Yeah. So you get this great package. It's really alluring. It's very prestigious, but you work mm-hmm. so hard. So it's like soul sucking, right?
It's soul sucking, and you have no control over your life. So you might actually sit there for 4 hours doing nothing, but then at 8 p.m., then they give you 10 hours of work. Oh. And it's as if the hours weren't bad enough, but the lack of control. So every time you made a plan with someone, you had to qualify it by saying, just so you know, I might cancel within 5 minutes of meeting you, or I might have to walk out in the middle of our engagement.
And
so living
point,
your life like that.
Yeah. At this point, are you still going back to that? I'm the hardest working though, and I'm okay with this. Is it still playing to that part of you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm so young, and all your peers are doing it. Entire city's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And people, and it's a badge of honor. You know, I was that guy, I'll sleep when I'm dead, you know, like, and kind of like, you know, poo-pooing others who only worked 9 hours, like, God, you know, or God forbid the French, I'm a quarter French, I could say that take 4 weeks, 6 weeks off in the summer. Like, you know, I was very titled about kind of my heavily air quoted privileged status in New York City.
Well, I think that's right. It's a badge of honor. Like, we are the sort of military elite of the hardworking people, right? Like, we're the ones who are up at the crack of dawn and work the hardest and in the trenches, and right? It's something mm-hmm. people feel proud of.
Absolutely. And the deals that we work on are on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, even though as an analyst, all it meant was you were the person kind of copy and pasting logos into a PowerPoint presentation. You know? it was like huge cognitive dissonance there, but you know, you tell people like, that was my deal. You know, did you see the journal today? I worked on that.
You're like, I got photos from the internet. That's totally awesome. So how many years were you in this firm?
So I actually tapped out of investment banking within 2 years. And I went to a different part of finance, which, again, it's crazy, but I only had to work 12 hours, but they were 12 consistent hours. And to this day, I still view a 12-hour workday, as long as it's consistent, as not that difficult and not that it's something I would not gladly do, but I have no problem doing it. And that's from that 2 year period. That's how I'm still wearing the scars of that 17 years later.
Well, it's kind of a muscle, no, that like you exercise and then you can go back too, would you say?
Yeah, I would. But I also think it's a dangerous, it's an unhealthy narrative that you need to unwind. So I think part of the muscle is I don't know what part is muscle, what part's narrative. It's a bit of both.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. That the narrative feeds your ability to do it, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You tell yourself.
As truism, it should be this way.
Right. Right. Because the mind is the thing to go, right? Like, you start feeling tired and fatigued. But if you have the right things to say to yourself at the right time, you can keep pushing through, and that can be unhealthy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you're in your 12-hour manageable day. How long did you do that for?
I did that for 2003. I did that for 12 years at two firms. And I shifted industries, shifted within the finance industry, but I was basically helping pension funds find hedge fund investments. So I was a little bit, you could think of it a little bit like a venture capitalist that goes around trying to find these small hedge funds and determine if we should make investments in them. And I did that at a small firm for 4 years and then at a large firm called BlackRock for the last 8 years.
And did you enjoy that time? Was it positive?
Yeah, I definitely liked it. I definitely didn't hate it. Listen to how I answered these questions. I definitely didn't hate it. And I definitely didn't love it, but I didn't actually dread going to work. So, again, stories to tell ourselves.
Yeah. So you had justified it. You had made peace with it, but you didn't love it.
Yeah, exactly. But I had a bit of a rocket ship career, especially in the back half of my career. And so that's when things were really good on the outside. You know, I was the highest title at a financial firm is managing director. And I became a managing director at age 31, when the average age was probably somewhere between like 38 and 42, I guess.
Yeah, so yeah. Hard to work that way. Those are hard to get. And that is very young to get there.
And so I had achieved a lot of these badges. And I was fine, but I was really, really, especially towards the end, intellectually empty. And the way I describe it is I was, you know, the difference between an I-shaped individual and a T-shaped individual. And so the I is the specialist. And so I was an expert at this tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of the investing universe. And I knew that world pretty well. But I did not do anything else other than look at that tiny sliver. And I wanted to learn about managing people. I wanted to learn about marketing. I wanted to learn about recruiting and building teams and all that. And so I've always been a very curious person. And I think my curiosity hit this end point because it was just stay there and just keep getting more and more specialized.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I've never heard the I versus the T. I love that.
Yeah.
So you make this bold move to walk out of this life where you're probably being paid really well, you're becoming very expert, you've managed to get yourself to a very high level. Tell me, walk us through what that decision process looked like and why that came up for you.
Absolutely. A lot of it had to do with, I'll take it back to my childhood, where I just thought that if you achieved, you would be happy.
Yeah.
And so as I hit these achievements, both financial and also status-wise, I would hit them and then life would get a little bit easier, would get us, you know, nicer apartment, buy a few nice things. But I realized that my baseline happiness was not changing at all. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I was kind of comfortably numb. I was trying to describe whether I liked it or I didn't. I didn't know. I was just kind of the proverbial, you know, coasting through life. Mm-hmm. Then we had a kid. And having a child really forces you to think about the passage of time. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know, my daughter was born when I was 34. Between say age 27 and 34, I couldn't really explain to you what happened in those 7 years. Like, yes, I met my wife and we got married, but it's kind of a big bit of a blur. But you have a child and then you're like measuring their lives in weeks first. And then the first birthday hits and like, oh my God, it's already been a year? What just happened? And then I could see 10 years going by with a snap of a finger with this intellectual curiosity unfulfilled in a, you know, meh job. And I could see it happening really quickly. I was like, I need to get off this. I need to get out. And so I did what the linear type A thinker would do. I tried to create a strategy. So I would wake up very early and write business plans, and I would try to learn new industries on the weekends and things like that. And then I realized that it's just not, if you want to create something, you can't do it with the residual amount of time you have after you do a 12-hour job, after you take care of your family. You're just not going to come up with your best self or ideas in that residual. It's natural. And so I finally got the courage to just walk away with no plan other than I had saved enough for 2 years of living expenses that I kind of put in a different account that I would just knew that was kind of the house money that was part of this kind of broader life experiment.
So take us back then to you put your resignation in. You have 2 years of money in the bank. Mm-hmm. What is the predominant feeling? Is it fear? Is it a combination of fear but like freedom? Like what's going on in that moment? I know when I left my company, I was totally overwhelmed, but there was this insane freedom. Like I remember walking down the street just feeling like, oh my God, like I just this lightness and something had opened up inside of me despite the crazy move I had just made leaving a, you know, golden handcuff kind of position.
Mm-hmm. It was, I have, because of my upbringing growing up kind of lower middle class, but very, very frugal. And the culturally, you know, my parents having come here with very little, there was always this mindset that everything could be taken from you at any point in time. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think I had crafted a life to protect myself from that happening. My parents definitely, they still are living with that mindset, even though they have two, you know, fully functional, self-sufficient children and plenty of retirement money. Uh-huh. But it is like, you know, so the fear is kind of bracing for the unexpected, you know, and I definitely had that when it came to financials. And so, you know, I could comfortably do this experiment, but I was still, you know, buying, I was like, should I buy this Starbucks coffee, like generic toothpaste versus, and then it's kind of, you reach this point, like you, why are you even worrying? If this is what's consuming you, you're not going to be able to create. And I think one of the big breakthroughs that I had is I started working with a coach a year before I left. And she very, very quickly identified this poverty mindset is what she called it. And it's very, very irrational. And now as I'm removed from it, I see and I study a lot of kind of neuroscience and evolutionary theory. But so much of it comes from our kind of caveman ancestry, where yes, you genuinely were at risk of dying if you put your guard down.
Yeah.
And I love this. I think Naval Ravikant said this once. He said, you know, with all these advances in technology, the human operating system is still 10,000 years old.
Right.
And so I had a very outdated operating system that was very easily triggered by these fears.
And I think for most of us, right, there's a sense that there's the proverbial bear in the bush when in fact, you know, we're living in the most abundant times, you know, in history, despite the difficulties we might experience.
And can I just add one thing?
Yeah.
It was so clear to me when I resigned from BlackRock, the first question everyone asked me as I left, and these were 20-year industry people, tons of savings and gigantic houses and stuff. First question everyone asked, what are you going to do about health insurance? And my answer is, oh, I'll pay for it. And it's something about, and health insurance like really cuts to, like, before everything that's happened now politically, like well before that, it cuts through that fear of survival, of money, of paying things out of pocket. And it was just, it made no sense. If anything, health insurance is the least risky thing when you leave a corporate job, because you know that for 18 months, you'll have the exact same health insurance. And if you can afford it, it's really expensive. But if you're able to afford it, nothing has actually changed.
That's right. That's so interesting that people would ask you specifically about health insurance, and that there's this sense of safety. If you're in a corporate environment, then, you know, you're not really at risk when, you know, there's layoffs all the time too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And let's be honest, you and the people you were talking to are very employable. It's not like...
That's the other thing. Yeah. And I still have to remind myself as I go through some of my darker days of entrepreneurship, when, you know, I call it like the royal flush, when my rent and my car payment and my daughter's, you know, daycare are all due, they all land on the same day, and I'm just cutting these checks. And I'm like, oh my God. And then I remind myself exactly what you just said, you know, you're on your plan, and there's a great chance that it won't work. And if it doesn't work, you probably can get a job.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny because a lot of people who don't have anything believe when I have stuff, that mindset will go away, and it doesn't. Mm. And, you know, I'm surrounded by a lot of people who have a lot of opportunity and income, and they still have that mindset. And I met one individual who said the opposite. He just had no fear. And we were all chatting, and he said, I can always get a job. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't know mm-hmm. why we don't have that sense. It's like, I'm going to be cast on the street, and that's it. Even for people who have, you know, built up their careers for a long, long time, there's that fear. So
you know what it is?
Yeah.
I use this pyramid that I call it the feararchy. It's a pyramid of fears. And I read about this in an article in Psychology Today. I'm not a psychologist or anything close to it. But at the base of the pyramid is it's survival. And at the top of the pyramid, it's what they call ego death. So like humiliation, failure, embarrassment, shame. And what happens is, if you don't have a good dialogue with your fears, you always will default to the lowest common denominator, which is extinction. Like, genetically, we're programmed for that. So what are you going to do about health insurance? Extinction. What are you going to do if you can't get a job? Extinction. You know, when really what people are saying is like, I don't know if I'd want that mediocre job, because I had this really great job now, and I'd be really embarrassed to go to my, you know, my local diner and people say, hey, you used to be an MD, but now you're, you know, a mid-level guy because you took 3 years off to do this entrepreneurship. That's what they're really saying, is like, I'm scared of being ashamed.
Yeah.
But the natural impulse is, I'm scared I'm going to be broke. And learning how to reconcile those two things is so empowering.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really great distinction. I've never heard anybody put it that way, but that's right. I'm not going to go broke. I just may need to take a few steps down, which it's embarrassing. It's also, are you really being honest with yourself? Are you prepared to pay that consequence and, you know, humble yourself and start over a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. At 35, you might not want to do what you did when you were 26.
Exactly. Exactly. And that takes me to the other feeling that I had very often after I left, was I didn't have a plan. And type A industries, type A professionals, they want to know that you have a plan. And you're an entrepreneur, you've been an entrepreneur, you know that creativity, what's that say? It's like, planning does not withstand first contact with the enemy, right? I'm misphrasing it. But, and I came, so after I left, I took a little, we took a family trip. We traveled for 3.5 months, and we came back, and I started thinking about what I was going to do next. And I would get a text, three texts a day. What are you doing, with a ARE in all caps? And you know, for someone that's just starting off as an entrepreneur, that's still kind of wrestling with this, you know, extinction versus shame, fear, you know, feeling. And it's just hard being an entrepreneur, not having a schedule, not having an office, you know, yeah. You're always working, all that stuff. You know, I just get back. The last thing I need is 3 finance people a day for 40 straight days texting me passive aggressively, what are you doing?
Oh my God, that's awful.
Like, and it really bothered me because they view the world, and I might be projecting here, so they viewed the world through 2 lenses. You're either working on something or you're on vacation. Uh-huh. And the more time I spend as being an entrepreneur, you're actually in the middle for most of the time. And the middle,
God,
is where the magic happens. But the middle is not an easy story to explain to people, right? Twitter did not start off as a 140 character app. It was a podcasting app, and Slack started off as a gaming company. But people don't recognize that. They just think that like an Apple hit Jack Dorsey on his head and he's like, everyone wants to communicate with 140 characters. Let's go build this.
Right, right. No, I mean, Groupon too. All of these companies, you know, they morphed over time, and so did ours. It's not entrepreneurial if you already got the answer and the client base, right? That's just a mm-hmm. business that'll blow up to a large business in a few hours. So yeah, mm-hmm. a lot of it is pivoting. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs get into it and they don't understand why it's taking so long, but mm-hmm. you're learning and growing and reinventing over and over and over as the market feeds back information to you.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so key. So how did RadReads come into this, and
yeah,
the topics that you talk about, how did that come into play?
Yeah, so it really shows the middle. You can't even predict it. So we go on this trip, come back, and I get, you know, 40 straight days, 120 texts, what are you doing? And I have a false, I thought when I left that I was going to start a fintech company because I like tech. I'm a finance person. 1 + 1 = 2.
And
so I started to go down that path, and I had this really silly thing. I've written about it a few times. And I had this thing where I said, I want to build a company and sell it for $50 million. And it's the stupidest thing in the world now in hindsight. But first of all, $50 million is so arbitrary. Like if you raised $49.9 million, you made $100,000. If you raise zero, you made $50 million. But the reason why I had picked 50 million is because it felt like it was big enough to be deemed hard,
uh-huh.
but not big enough for me to come across as an entitled and arrogant prick.
Right, right. Because if you said I want to do a billion, people would be like, oh,
exactly.
Get over yourself.
Oh, you're no Mark Zuckerberg, you know? And so I literally thought, I've written about this, that was what I was going to do. And again, I was equating achievement with happiness. And I went down that path very briefly, and I had done enough self-exploration during the trip, and I had a coach and all that, and I was miserable. And I said, I did not make these big life changes to just do something else, along that vein. But that was my ego talking. You know, it wanted to know that I was important. And I finally let go of that. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to work on, you know, I had, of the 2 years, I had 16 months left or something like that. I said, I'm just going to work on things that make me happy. And this was about January of 2016. And like my dad said, we may not be the smartest, but we're the hardest working. Like, I know how to put in the hours.
Yeah.
And so I got an office in January of 2016, and I had this small newsletter that was just kind of a fun thing that was just curating 5 interesting stories for friends. Had a couple hundred people. So I decided to make that a little nicer. I designed the logo myself. You know, I was in that middle zone of playing around and trying to become an entrepreneur and trying to explore ideas. And I was finding a lot of joy. I really enjoyed learning how to use Sketch to make a logo. I'm not a creative person in that regard. And I was just kind of really letting joy guide me. And then my newsletter was around kind of living living your truth, living your best version of yourself. But what I realized was I was hiding behind curation. So I would pick an article about stoicism or something like that. And I'd say, this person, like Ryan Holiday, says that stoicism is good because when something happens in his life, he's able to do this and shut it off. And what I realized was I wanted to say that that was my opinion, but I didn't have the confidence to put it out there publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was hiding behind curation.
Like, who am I to be the voice of this, right?
Yeah,
somehow Ryan has the permission, but I don't.
Absolutely. And I really thought, like, you have to be an expert to express any opinions. And God, the internet has really thrown that one out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggled with that one so much, right? Like, my big one was I have to have a PhD to talk about any of this.
Exactly. And I totally felt that. And my friends were wondering, like, what do you know about the compassion or what do you know about stoicism or Buddhism?
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I just said, you know, screw it. I'm sick of hiding behind this curation. And I just started writing. And I just kind of was writing about paper. It may look like I have my shit together. But deep inside, I'm really harsh on myself. I'm very confused. I didn't really like my job. I can't be present around my daughter because my mind's always racing. I have trouble sleeping. And I just kind of, and then like dot, dot, dot. And I'm really scared of my own death. And I just kind of put it out there.
That's awesome. And how did that moment feel? Was that like...
It was cathartic. I mean, there are still things on my blog that I haven't told my wife because it's easier to say to, you know, thousands of anonymous strangers than to the person that you love the most. And, you know, everyone has their mediums that work for them. It makes for interesting, like, marital fights when she things like, you didn't tell me that you're thinking this. It's like, yes, it's in my blog, you know, like volume 83. She's like, I don't read your blog.
Yeah. Why would I read your blog? I talk to you every day. I'm sick of you. That's hilarious. And so where do you get your inspiration? Like, do you have, so Buddhism and Stoicism and all of these things, are you just an avid reader? Do you immerse yourself in different topics? Where did all this come from?
Yeah, I think that I always was a kind of life hacker. And so in my early 20s, the hacking was around productivity and efficiency and, you know, burpees and cold showers and all that stuff. And then what happened was I just kind of started diving. You know, people would give me a strand of something and I would just kind of dive into it and kind of trace back the influences. So it really is a mix of, in terms of mediums, it was a mix of books. I read a lot, podcasts, blogging, conversations with folks, YouTube videos. But I think the thing that really kind of made crystallize things for me was that I love looking for interdisciplinary patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like, if I found an idea in one place, I would try to pull it as far as possible to another extreme. And so the example that I love to use, and I love pop culture. And so there was a lot of, my writing voice, I think my personality too, is a very kind of pop culture-ish voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why it's called Rad Reads. It's my homage to skate and surf culture. I love hip hop. I love sneakers, you know. So I try to take these topics that are pretty, you know, intense and sometimes, you know, dark, and just try to put them in a language that's a little bit more accessible and really playful. And I think one big inspiration is Tim Urban from Wait But Why. You know, he just goes there, but he's got these stick figure monsters that explain, you know, your ego and things like that. And so I'd be remiss if I didn't say I was inspired by him. But the example that I love to use is about money, and this fear of money is the entertainer The Rock. And I just read this little quote about him where he said, you know, The Rock was homeless many times as a child, and he bulked up and became a bodybuilder/wrestler. And so to him, physical fortitude or his body was basically his way to ensure that he wouldn't be homeless. And so he talks about now, you know, he's probably in his late 40s or mid 40s, that he still wakes up every morning at 4 a.m. and works out really hard for 2 hours. And then he says, he just has one sentence. He says, to me, that's how I remind myself that I'll never be homeless again.
Mm.
This was the year that he made $64 million. And so, but it's a kind of that reminder to, you know, I always tell people there is no there. You don't get there. Whatever is unsettled in you, it's not going to, you're not going to hit a milestone and it will just vanish away. And so that taking that story and instead of saying like, hey, like managing director in finance that had, you know, these fears and insecurity, it's like, no, it's The Rock and he has more money than anyone ever. So it's clearly the money is not going to make that deep-seated anxiety go away. No. And I think it was very good at bringing those stories together for people.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. And, you know, I don't know, it's like our culture just perpetuates this lie and talks about this idea of success as money and therefore happiness. But it is just mm-hmm. success to money, and money is nice and it's pleasurable. But mm-hmm. Tony Robbins has recently started saying success, there's a science to success, right? Getting money and all that, accolades, you know, the awards, but fulfillment is an art, right? I think that's a really mm-hmm. awesome way of talking about it, because it's a completely different thing to find the happiness and fulfillment and contentment in your life than to get these rewards. But it's like, no matter how many times I feel like people are trying to say this, culture is pushing mm-hmm. the opposite, you know, in such an intense way, it's hard to battle. So you talk about all these concepts, you tie them together with pop culture, but we were talking before we hopped on, and I want to get to these 4 points that you feel are really sort of, I guess, the core of how you think about these steps in, mm-hmm. in one's life. And you start with self-compassion, which uh-huh. I've heard a lot. I love compassion, but typically that's at the end. So tell me why that's sort of your first step and where these steps come from a bit.
Mm-hmm. And so self-compassion was the nagging, berating, outright cruel voice in my head that basically for 35 years was on repeat saying, you're not doing enough. And every time there was a mistake, it went nuclear on me. And so something as basic as, you know, we have unlimited transit cards here. And so if you forget yours at home, you have to pay, but you already paid for the unlimited one. And I would blow up on myself in my own head for 40 minutes. It's like, you're never going to amount to anything. How do you want to be a professional? How do you want to be a managing director at BlackRock if you can't even remember to, you know, keep your unlimited MetroCard in your wallet and things like that? So if that's the voice for a $2.75 transit fare, imagine like giving a presentation in front of 100 people. And it was, but I believed, and I don't believe this anymore, but I believed that you needed fear as a motivator. If you weren't afraid, you wouldn't perform. And so that voice was so brutal. And I realize it now. I think I ask people, what's the ratio of good voice to mean voice in your head? And for me, it was 90% mean, 10% nice. And I flipped it to 10% nice, might even be 10% mean to 90%. Nice. And all of a sudden, life just like it just the volume of life just goes from like death metal to like no pun intended to that like soothing massage studio jingles and like just like that. And so it was. And I share this story with people. And the number one thing is people come back to me like, yep. Art that you're describing the voice in my head. And that was the first real thing to let go. I didn't even really realize how draining that was, how limiting that was.
And I want to stop here because I say this is at the end of a lot of things because people have so much pushback. So I can imagine people listening right now and they're like, dude, whatever. all of that negativity. You achieved so much. You went to Yale. You're making all this money. You know, now after you've had a lot of success, you're kind of like easing it up. But I coach people, and this is something that I swear it's like I want to stand on my head and spin to try to get this point across. And I'm 45. I've had success, and so I run into this block. That's not how it works. Without this edge, I'll never have success. Show me examples of people who have had success who didn't do this at some point, right? That negativity, that aggression, that sort of self-hatred and being hard on myself, it motivates me. And if I take the pedal off, right, Gonzo, I'm just going to go sit on a beach somewhere. I will never get anything done. So what do you say? Because I've had the same experience. I've completely flipped the script, and I still work so hard. I mean, I get put in 12-hour days still, but I'm happy. I don't feel tired. I suppose I should say I feel tired, but I don't feel stressed. I don't feel depleted. Yeah. I don't feel like there's a hole in my soul by the end of the week. So talk to me a little bit about this idea of how do I not lose my edge, or, you know.
Yeah.
It's easy for you to say really, since you've already got success. Yeah,
totally. I call it the Ariana Huffington effect, where it's like, of course she could tell me to sleep more. She has three assistants who answer her phone in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so I'll use a personal example, and depending on the time, I'll use a public example. But I was never a good public speaker. In fact, my whole finance career, I did a lot of things well, but my one kind of constant knock was that I wasn't a confident speaker. I was nervous. I didn't have confidence. I used a lot of filler words. I wasn't good at forming narratives and all that stuff. A year later, I get invited to give a TED talk, TEDx talk, and TEDx is no joke. You have a lot of deliverables months in advance. And so my talk is in London, and I fly to London 1 week in advance of my talk. And so I have two very clear, because I had to give a lot of talks in finance. I have two very clear examples. So old K would have rehearsed 4 to 6 hours a day, would have carried his notes everywhere, would have been mumbling to himself in the subway and the tube, and would have done that for every day for the week leading up to the talk.
Okay.
New K went in and said, what am I most afraid of? Like, what is really the worst thing that could happen to me? And so the worst thing that could happen, I think, would be I get up on stage, I trip, I get up, I forget all of my lines, and I blab for 2 minutes and walk off the stage.
Yep.
That's probably the worst thing that could happen.
Right.
So
people laugh at while you're tripping.
Exactly. Let's go back to the fear pyramid, right? The bottom is extinction and the top is humiliation. So old K would have said, if that chain of events were to happen, you then suck as an entrepreneur, all your businesses will fail, and by the way, you're going to die one day. but it would like quickly go there.
Yeah.
It would definitely go there with like, you're not going to be successful at being an entrepreneur. You can't even do a TED Talk. New K was said, yeah, that would be kind of a bummer to be humiliated. Oh, well, like, I'm not that. They'll probably forget in a day anyway. And if not, like, I'll just own that I was the guy that fell on the stage.
Mm.
Two very different conversations. Now, multiply that conversation. So take the first one, like, you suck, you're the worst entrepreneur on the planet. And multiply that by 6 hours a day of rehearsal, motivated by that, for 7 straight days in a beautiful city of London where I have nothing else to do other than think about my talk and visit some friends and go, like, to pubs. New K. One rehearsal in front of my laptop, 15 minutes, no notes, nothing.
Come on.
For 7, swear to God, hand on my heart. On top of that, I was the third to last speaker the day of the event. I didn't even, so 7 hours of people talked before me. I did not look at my notes once.
And how did it go?
I think I crushed it.
I mean, I checked you out. You looked pretty good to me. That does not look like somebody who spent 15 minutes in front of a computer. That's amazing.
Point being,
though, yeah, I was getting a little animated too, that you picked a topic that you're being asked to speak because you obviously have something that people want to hear. You therefore probably know already what you're talking about. And so going through this whole game that you're not worthy and not good enough and everything is ridiculous. You have 15 minutes of content. We're sitting here at 46 minutes and we're still chatting. So why, I think to your point is like, why be so hard on yourself just because you're going up in this moment? Just deliver something great and let the rest work itself out.
Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't even say deliver something great. Just deliver.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair.
And whatever happens, happens. And this is the part that I tell people, like the people, the edge people with air quotes. It's like, you do less work and it's better. Like anyone who wants edge, those are the words you live by. Less work, better.
Right. Would you say like it's not about cramming and crushing and trying to get in on those edges and everything. It's just like doing the work on a consistent basis and learning the topic that you're interested in because you love it.
Mm-hmm. And separating those fears.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you remove the fear of a bad TED Talk, like really coloring my entrepreneurship, then you change the whole discussion.
Yeah.
In your head.
Yeah. And you know, people think you get to a certain stature, a certain point, and those imposter voices, that fear is supposed to go away. And it doesn't unless you confront it head on. I love mm-hmm. that story. That is awesome. And so self-compassion.
Being uncomfortable introspection.
But self-compassion being the key thing to starting to release those fears, but it doesn't transmit into you losing the edge. In fact, you're still, you know, doing great and finding a lot of success. And there's an ease of life that comes from mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
And that was the best week in London I've ever spent. I like think back so fondly of those 7 days and the, you know, hundreds of dollars that I spent just getting there.
Yeah. Instead of over a 15 minute moment, ruining the whole thing with endless fear of shame and
exactly.
extinction. And so, okay. So second point, I could talk about the first one for 2 hours. So I'm just going to force myself to move forward, but uncomfortable introspection. What do you mean by that?
And so really, I mean, we've covered this in our conversation. It really is leaning into your fears and understanding them. I think many high achieving folks, and I think males in particular, there's a belief that you take your fears, you put them in a box, and you bury them in your backyard and throw some dirt over it, and you'll never have to deal with them again.
Yeah.
And that's just... it's just wrong.
Well, man up, right?
Not only is it wrong, but the time when you are least equipped to deal with those fears is when you'll be forced to confront them. So again, I tell my edge-seeking people that in finance, the day that the stock market falls 15% in one day, the Black Mondays of the world, the global financial, whatever fear you're carrying will reemerge at that specific moment in time when you probably have to make the biggest decision of your career.
Mm. So clear out the proverbial closet before you get there.
Mm-hmm. And separate that, you know, separate the shame from the things that you can control. I mean, how much, that's the other thing for the edge people is I like the name, is that how much time do you spend worrying about things that you literally have no control over?
Oh yeah, that's a great game. I'm expert at that one, and I like keep thinking over the years I'm getting better, and because I'm knocking them out, and then I find out I'm doing it again somewhere else. I'm like, God, right? Like, oh my God, I'm doing it again. I'm trying to influence something where I have no influence. It is. I think for high achieving people, though, would you say it's like there's a sense of progress and productivity, and sometimes you just forget to look and ask yourself, do I have any influence here? Do I have any control? If not, what am I doing? Expending energy.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to get a little deep here. I think within the fear, a big part of it that I know for myself is a fear of my own mortality. The fear that I like at some point, I'm not going to matter to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot. I mean, it's called like terror management theory in psychology. But the real book that cracked this open, it's even in the first chapter, is Ernest Becker's The Denial of Death.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever read that.
I
but
haven't.
He makes a very simple argument He said, the thing that makes us human is that we have consciousness, and that enables us to look forward and look backwards. When we look for, that's what separates us from animals.
Right.
When we look forward, we realize that one day we won't exist anymore. And so that triggers such an uncomfortable feeling in ourselves that we feel like we have to live heroic lives. We have to build that $50 million company. We have to solve that disease. We have to write the great American novel. And that, especially as society secularizes, you know, an achieving person is used to things such as, like, I put in more units of effort and more outcomes tend to go my way. And that's true to some extent. But if this is the mortality is the ultimate equalizer. The richest man in the world, the poorest person in the world, it doesn't matter. And I think that when I really got to the core of my fears, that was the one that was holding me back, is that I wanted to live a heroic life and I actually don't want to anymore.
Interesting. So then what is the driving motivator for you?
The driving motivator is joy in the moment. I know, like, that sounds super woo, but I know you get me on this.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean that I don't want to work.
Yep.
But it means, far from it, it means that I want to savor the moments as they happen. So, Laura, if I won the lottery yesterday, I would have the same day today.
Yep.
We would be talking today.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more. And I don't know if that will hold true tomorrow. I don't know if that will hold true in a year. I don't know if it'll hold true in 20 years. I don't know if I'll be around in 20 years. But I am no longer scared of that. I mean, I still, like, I'm not totally not unafraid of it. But knowing that I did that, that, like, that's the best I can give.
Yeah. Isn't that the greatest feeling to know that
fun.
even if something radical came, like the lottery, I still would be doing what I'm doing. There's nothing better. I 100% feel that way at this point in my life. Like, before it was to earn money or to get to a certain point, but that doesn't really bring that fulfillment to know mm-hmm. that each day is the day that I'm choosing to have. And mm-hmm. these are the conversations I want to be having. And I no longer do anything that I don't want to do. And I always say this to people that, sometimes I'm doing things that I don't want to do because there's a larger goal that I do want. And so, you know, mm-hmm. like, I don't want to load my blog into MailChimp particularly, which is the software mm-hmm. you use. It's really annoying.
Yes, me neither.
But I want to have this blog, so it's worth it to me. But I just mean, I don't do things that really on all levels, I just don't want anymore. And it's such a wonderful way to live your life. We do so much from obligation and, you know, all these external concepts that we've bought into. So what is then the stillness is your third point?
Stillness is, I want to quote Naval Ravikant, who says, he has a quote that says, the busy mind accelerates the passage of subjective time. And so
I'm closing my eyes. I like that one out. Okay.
Yeah. I'll say it again slowly. The busy mind accelerates the passage of subjective time.
Yeah, that's good.
And I tell my edge people, I invert that. I say the quiet mind slows down the passage of subjective time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, we always want to slow down time, right? There's never enough time. You slow down time, you want to slow down time in the midst of crises. You want to slow down time when you're with your family. You want to slow down time when you're flowing creatively. You want to slow down time if you're optimizing for joy in the moment. Make it as slow as possible.
So, okay, like then that makes sense to me that you've put it here, because if you say slow down time first, but mm-hmm. I slow down time just to recognize that I have no self-compassion, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
like, mm-hmm. I think the most right awareness and all that stuff people struggle with, because if they turn inward, there's mm-hmm. so much self-abuse happening, right? That mm-hmm. you just don't want.
Yep.
Staying busy is an antidote to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was that person.
Yeah. Me too.
I mean, I sprinted through 35 years at a relentless pace, and I just cracked emotionally.
Yeah.
And so stillness, and they all work together, right? You can't confront the fears if your mind's not being still. And you can be compassionate if you're just constantly motivated by fear, because it's kind of like this like primal force in your body and in your mind.
I love it. And so then the fourth is truth, living in truth.
Living your truth, yes. And that is really kind of detaching. You know, I guess the Buddhists will call it non-attachment, but it's really, I guess, what is it, Mark Manson?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the subtle art of not giving a fuck.
Right.
And it's just, we're so captive to other people's stories, right? When I was getting those texts, what are you doing? Why does that even matter?
Oh,
and the
God.
Day that it stopped mattering was the day that my creativity and joy took off.
Yeah. I'm
and
like
people
sick
at the
for
beginning,
you that
when I,
people were saying that. That's just the worst. 40 texts, that's crazy. Right. But it's like this pressure, and then we start living other people's dreams, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that the day that I let go of that, and it's a long prayer because I went extreme in that end where I, you know, as a male finance guy, you don't talk about your insecurities ever. You don't acknowledge them to yourself, let alone like make Snapchat videos about them. I mean, my friends were, they tell me now that I've had like, I've hit a little bit of, you know, air quotes success. They tell me now, we had these group texts going around where we'd say, hey, did you see his Snapchat today? What is going on with him? They're like, they were genuinely, you know, they were the people that were projecting like the, what are you doing? And then there were the other people that were just genuinely concerned for my well-being because
right,
I had done something so off the path.
Yeah, like he's cracked.
So vulnerable. Yeah, he's lost it.
Yeah. It's like, meanwhile, lost it. You found joy and peace and stillness and happiness and flow and calm, and you're the one who's lost it. It's quite ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I use this term, it's a finance term, but there's a phrase from Keynes that says, markets can stay irrational longer than investors can stay so longer than you have enough capital to hold, you're forced to sell it. And I adapt that to myself and I just say the world can remain irrational longer than I can stay emotionally solvent. And so as I increase my emotional solvency, like people could tell me for a year straight now that I've lost my mind. And it's just, I'll listen for feedback, but I'm not going to let the like, you're doing something so different get to me, you know? So that's my emotional solvency. And the more runway you give yourself in emotional solvency through those tools we discussed, self-compassion, looking within, fear, quieting the mind, then you're like, you're unstoppable. You truly are unstoppable.
Yeah. Yeah. Because then the external world doesn't, you know, knock you off your feet and your own mind doesn't take you down.
Exactly. And your truth emerges.
Yes. Yes.
And like you can't compete with truth. Like, like truth is truth. Like
nothing better than when your own truth is there and you accept it. So I ask everybody who comes on the show, what does an authentic life mean to you? So I'm going to ask you, what does that mean to you?
It means, and this was the greatest piece of advice I think I've ever gotten in my life, said, if you really want to be kind to someone, share vulnerably with them.
That's so
and so
beautiful.
That is authenticity to me. And it's taken me a long time to find that. And really it's my friend Sunil who taught me that years ago. And so, yes, sharing vulnerably, the things that come from sharing vulnerably are incredible. And you unlock something in others by giving them that space to go there. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing.
And we talked about your story and we talked about the concepts around your life now. And what, though, do you have as daily practices? Are you somebody who journals, meditates, walks? Mm-hmm. What do you do to stay in this these mindsets?
Yeah. And practice. I'm glad you said it, Laura. There is, you know, I've been saying this more and more, there is no there. You don't get there.
No.
There just is. And whatever I'm saying today might not hold tomorrow. And all I know is how my practice, you know, how true I am to my practice and how it evolves. Pragmatically, what that means is, and I told people this, I invest almost 2.5 hours of my time to myself per day. And people are like, you're so selfish. You have a family, you have a daughter, a pregnant wife, and all that stuff. And it's, I do 40 minutes. I meditate 40 minutes a day. I work out for an hour a day. And then I do yoga for 20 minutes a day. And then I read like physical books for 15 to 30 minutes a day, pretty much every day.
Yeah, it's funny to live a life where you can feel good, contribute, feel positive. You have to take care of yourself. And again, this is that same mindset. Then people say it's selfish, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Is yoga?
And I wouldn't trade that for, I would not trade that. There's no amount of money I would trade those 2.5 hours for. They have no financial value to me. Or they have infinite financial value to me, I guess.
Yeah, and all of these things happen because you've taken care of yourself, right? But there is this mindset that there's something selfish in taking care of your body and your mind. It's amazing to me. So if people want to find out more about you, hear more of your story, where can they find you?
Yes, thank you for asking. I write on, I mean, the main Rad Reads, I guess, experience is the email and newsletter. And so you could sign up on radreads.co, which is where I also write my original writing. I am Quartz's entrepreneur in residence, the media company. So actually most of my writing is now on Quartz.
I love Quartz, but Quartz is awesome.
Oh, Quartz is awesome. Everything about, I love Quartz, and it's a really special place to me. Again, Quartz entrepreneur in residence. Like, I was a blogger for the first time in January of 2016.
Yep.
So, and then this is where it gets really fun, is I just interact a lot with people on Snapchat, where I'm Rad Reads, and Instagram, where I'm my full name, which is Kemred. And I just, it's kind of stream of consciousness, but I tell daily stories around these different themes. And today was a really funny story. I know we're stretched for time, but I said, try naming the voice in your head. And I suggested three names. The first was the Destroyer. The second was the Butthead. And the third one was Mr. Salty Poops. And my social feeds went crazy. They were like, obvious, Mr. Salty Poops definitely touches a nerve with people. And it's just such an ironic name for that cruel voice in your head.
Uh-huh.
And so those are the kind of videos that I make on Snapchat. So again, super serious topic, self-compassion, but come on, let's have fun.
Totally, because that's the whole thing, right? Our minds make it seem like this stuff is so serious, and if you talk about it, you'll be found out, and everybody is going to think less of you. So, you know, the lighter you can get, the better.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today's show, sharing with all of us your ideas, and I've really thoroughly enjoyed myself, and, you know, just appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you to all your listeners. It's been really, it's a privilege, and most importantly, it's been really, really fun.